Back to the book of Judges. Judges 13:5. The last time we started on Samuel, we were, not Samson that is, I was looking at some things on Samuel last night, but anyway, on Samson, we were talking about how God used an unusual call with the angel of the Lord to announce to Manoah and his wife that they were going to have a special child. And as the announcement is made to them, verse 4 of Judges 13, the wife is cautioned, be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and do not eat anything unclean. And verse 5 says, you will conceive and bear a son and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. The story of Samuel is just such, Samson is such an unusual story anyway, but if you recall, when they went into the land to capture it, God says you can have complete victory. It's yours. But you're going to have to work for it. But it's guaranteed. So as they went in, they captured these 21 cities in red. Now, Jerusalem, they didn't really capture that as a city. They overcame the king of Jebus, it was called at that time, when an amalgamation of five kings down in this area fought against Israel. But they are listed as one of the 21 kings they overcame. Now, the problem is that the Philistines, who had iron chariots, were such a strong warrior class that Judah kind of ran out of energy, and they stopped short of conquering the territory of the Philistines. The tribe of Dan, which is going to be up in this area, stopped short conquering the area controlled by the Amorites. And then all the way up through here, there were certain pockets. They may have captured the city, but they didn't capture the environs. And God said, if you leave those people there, they will be a snare to you. It's not necessarily that the presence of the people would be a problem, but human nature is such that if they were to live amongst these pagans, it would rub off on them. And sure enough, that is what happened as we get into the story a little bit later. They divided up the land, and of course, this area of Dan is where Samson comes from. And if you recall so far, we see that the threat of the surrounding nations is beginning to pick up. And of course, it takes them years. Actually, they are fighting for at least 7 years to conquer the area before Caleb chooses his mountain. But anyway, we're in the period of the Judges. So up here, this area of Syria attacks, and Othniel, the first judge, helps them to overcome. Then Ehud comes, and he, of course, is fighting the threat of these Amalekites and Moabites and the Ammonites as they come against Israel. Shamgar down here is one of the first ones mentioned that will fight against the Syrians. Barak and Deborah, there is a king up here of Hazor who attacks from the north. So Barak and Deborah rise to the occasion there. Then from the Midianites down here, Midianites being Abraham's son by Keturah, but they were jealous of the Jews as well. They were roving marauders. So they decide, hey, there's some good things happening here. And it was just too tempting. They decided to invade and get some of the grain crops because, again, they were not into farming and things like that of that much. And then, of course, the Ammonites fight, and Jephthah rises to the occasion. So that's six of them so far. So you can see here, by not routing out these enemies, it created a problem. And, of course, they weren't to touch these over here because they were children of Lot. Now, Samson arises because the Philistines are a threat. Now, the first verse says that it's because Israel did evil that God turned them over to the Philistines for 40 years of captivity. So the only reason they are a threat is because Israel has failed. So you can see here the plot thickens as we come to the story of Samuel. The first part of the book here has to do with the spiritual lethargy. They just settled. They could have had it all, but they were just tired of fighting. They wanted to go on with their own life. They had a comfort zone, and they didn't want to be disturbed. So because of their apathy, they let these tribes remain amongst these people groups, remain amongst the tribes of Israel. That, of course, we're not going to go back to that. And I purposely call this next section that we're in now Surrender at Liberty, because they turned over the freedom that they had by choosing to engage in sin. They just surrendered it. I look at our country, and I see a lot of the socialist things that are happening from a governmental standpoint, and they are going to attack the freedoms that were ours from the time the first settlers came over here. And after a while, we'll find that we Christians will be the ones who will be targeted to lose our rights. You can see it all over now. The Oregon ruling, 137,000 fine, was just upheld by the Oregon courts. Now, if that had happened to a Jewish baker who refused to put a cross on top of a Christian's cake, or if it had happened to an Islamic baker, you can rest assured it would never see the light of day in courts. But because it's a Christian who says, my conscience will not permit me to do that. And by the way, it was a situation where they were perfectly willing to sell them anything they wanted, cupcakes or anything, but they could not offer their individual services, personalization services, to make it distinctively, homosexual for a gay wedding. Well, mark my words, we've already started compromising freedoms, but the key is we're losing our freedoms because the church and Christians have not done our job. We've gotten so comfortable. And I'm not talking about going out on the sidewalks and carrying sandwich boards and placards and all the other stuff. I'm simply saying that most of us, and probably most churches, have been lured into a place of real lethargy. We've just had it good for so long, it just didn't occur to us that the enemy was staying up late having their planning sessions, and we're getting blindsided, and we're wondering what hit us. So there are seven cycles of rebellion here, and now that's going to lead to what we're going to get into next, but that's not for today. But with Samuel, there's an important thing we need to understand. He was a person who was miraculously chosen for a great and noble purpose. Before his birth, Jeremiah chapter 1, before I knew you, before you were in the womb, I knew you and ordained you to be a prophet. In other words, we're not so much concerned here about what God foreordains, but God foreknows the people he wants to use for different kinds of work and ministries, and he decides he's going to step into the life of Manoah and his wife and give him a child, and he's going to claim him for his purposes. And by the way, it says here, starting to deliver Israel from the Philistines. He didn't finish the job. But when he brought down the house, the temple, with 3,000 of the military men, that set the stage for Samuel to come in later and overcome the Philistines at a place called Mizpah. But Samson himself did not live to see it. But he was chosen by God. Now, you and I, by the way, we're chosen by God. We don't have to get into why he chooses us. I'm convinced it's foreseen faith. I'm absolutely convinced that you and I have been delegated free will by a sovereign God. And he expects us to make the choices that honor him. But the fact is, every one of you who is named in the name of Christ, God already knew well in advance, centuries before you were born, how he would love to use you. Maybe it's to be a parent who just wants to pass along their convictions to their children. And even though that's somewhat minimized today, you're a stay-at-home mom, Don't you do anything important? Don't you have a job? Don't you have a career? I tell you, if you miss out as a father or mother on rearing your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you've lost most of the battle. It's an important job. It's one we need to take seriously. So the mission then is stated, and again, years before it takes place. He's divinely sanctified, set apart. Nazarite vow. They were not to drink wine. They were not to really touch anything unclean. They were not to cut their hair during the period of the vow. Over in the book of Acts, Paul takes a vow for a period of time and then cuts his, that was part of the Jewish heritage. He cuts his hair and then makes an offering to the Lord. But God simply said, this person is one I won't set aside so that other people can see he uniquely belongs to me. Well, that's a high calling. But you know that's true of us too. He has made us accept in the Beloved. And in fact, what is it? Forgotten whether it's 1st or 2nd Thessalonians. God has called us to sanctification. He's called us to be set apart people. By the way, the old King James says peculiar people. It doesn't mean odd. It just means set aside for a purpose. When you look at a certain gemstone, there are characteristics that it has that are peculiar to that. So if you and I are a peculiar people, we're distinctively people who belong to God. And then divinely strengthened. There are four places in this book that God's Spirit comes upon Samson, and he was able to do miraculous, supernatural feats of strength. Now, it's kind of odd. We wonder why he used Samson, but let's get into that just a little bit later. Let's look, first of all, at Samson's exploits. He sees a woman at a place called Timnah, which is way, way down there in the southeast area of Dan. So he says to his father, I've seen a really pretty girl, and I want you to go get me for her because the father has made arrangements for marriages. And his father said, you mean you can't even find one girl in Israel that you'll be happy with? Now, I've set my eyes on this one. She pleases me well. So they went down to arrange for his marriage. On the way, they must have gotten separated a bit because his parents didn't know that this happened. But on the way, a lion comes out and catches him by surprise. And it says that the spirit came upon him. That's where I put the dove. I put that as a symbol and several of these things in here. And because of that enabling, he was able to tear that lion apart just like a man would tear a young goat. Anyway, he killed the lion. But he didn't tell his parents. Well, now that's really an unusual thing. But then later, when he goes back to have the wedding feast, he steps over to where he left the body of that lion, and he sees there kind of a dried carcass in the hot heat over there. They would have dried out in a hurry. It doesn't matter how dried out it would be. I don't think I would want any honey from the empty carcass of a lion. But anyway, he sees the honey there. And isn't that interesting? Honey was okay for someone who had a Nazarite vow. But the fact it was in a dead animal was not all right. So he just bends over, he takes some of the honey, he eats it, gives it to his parents. Leviticus 11 makes it very clear that they were not to touch an unclean animal, or if they did, even by accident, they were to be unclean toward the evening. But he knew that that was a violation of his vow. But he saw the honey and figured, I want some of that. So, amazing story there. Then at the wedding feast, 7 days of wedding feast, I wonder if he drank wine at that feast. Almost everybody else did, by the way. It doesn't say he did. But what he does there, he I don't know if he's full of himself or he just likes a challenge. So he throws out this challenge, and he said, if you tell me the answer to my riddle, I'll give you 40 changes of raiment. So out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. Well, we know what he meant. Of course, now, when they were not able to guess, I wonder, would he have told them the truth? about what had happened with this. But anyway, it was a riddle. Finally, the seventh day of the feast, they went to his new wife and said, "You have to find out what the answer to this riddle is." They put a lot of pressure on her. After all, her husband was not one of her home people. So she probably had conflicted loyalties. I don't even really know what she thought of Samson personally. It doesn't say that. But anyway, she appealed to him, and he finally broke down and told her. She told them, and then finally on that seventh day of the feast, they come back to him and said, what's stronger than a lion and what's sweeter than honey? That's all they said. But he knew that his new wife had betrayed him. All right, now what to do? You owe him 30 changes of raiment. They didn't have Page One or another little thrift store around. And probably it would have been beneath his dignity, but he needs 30 changes of clothing. And in a way, this looks kind of like a sordid story, but it happens. He goes out and kills 30 of the Philistines, swipes their clothing off of them, just leaves them lying there in their skivvies, and he carries all this clothing back and plops it down and says, "There's 30 changes of raiment." Well, that didn't make them any too happy, but he left. He stalked off. So his father-in-law figures that maybe Samson was really good and mad at his wife. He wasn't even going to talk to her again. So he takes Samson's new wife and gives her to Samson's best man in the wedding. Well, now, Samson was really irritated at that. Now, I don't know how he did this. It doesn't say anything about the spirit in this instance. But he rounds up all these foxes, 300 of them, as a matter of fact. Then he ties two of them, ties them together in pairs, tail to tail, and lights the tails, and then they head out through the wheat crops. Now, it's bad enough to have locusts and things, but when you have fires devastating a new, well, it wasn't new, but it was wheat ready to be harvested. I mean, it went up like a prairie brush fire. So the Philistines said, "What in the world happened here?" Somebody who knew said, it's Samson. You know, his wife kicked him off and her father was in on it. So they come to the house of Samson's wife and her father and they burn them. So they kill them. And of course, then Samson hears, "All right, then I'm not going to stop with the Philistines until I get my vengeance." So when the Philistines come against him, he simply picks up the jawbone of a donkey or a mule, and he fights them, and he kills 1,000 of them. Now, Shamgar earlier had killed a number of them with an ox goad, but not 1,000 like this man did here. But again, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he was able to exert that superhuman strength. Now, this is where the story gets unfortunate, because it simply shows that Samson is only too human. His wife is dead, so he's on the way out of town, and he sees this red light in a window. So anyway, he engages the services of a prostitute, and he goes in for the evening. They, the Philistines, lay an ambush around the house, and they say, when he comes out, we'll finally capture him. Isn't it too bad when your enemies know that you're in a place they're not supposed to be? Isn't it too bad when unbelievers know that you and I are in territory that is forbidden to us? It's something that can easily happen, isn't it? Well, he waits until midnight because he figures they probably are going to come into dawn. So he walks over to the city gates, rips those gates off the hinges. Now, some of these gates are really heavy. Some of them, it took several men just to close one of them, even on the hinges. So he just lifts that thing up, including the post, and he carries it. If he took it all the way to Hebron, that's 38 miles. but it simply says on the hill toward Hebron. So anyway, he wanted to make sure they knew what he could do. So he just didn't leave it lying there. He just carried it right up the hill yet and left it lying there as a witness against them. And of course, you and I can never do that. Now we come to the final failure. We don't know that much about Delilah. Doesn't say she was an immoral woman. It just gives her location. It doesn't say she was patriotic, which accounts for what she did. It doesn't say that she was greedy, although they did promise her a whole bunch of talents of gold for helping out. But anyway, he sees this woman, Delilah, and he decides this is the woman for him. Now, isn't it interesting when we talk about temptation, we put a pretty woman up there. Well, human nature is such that this is, in our culture, a sensual culture. This is the way we kind of picture temptation, because this is the front where the greatest challenge comes, even to our young people, who even on TV are being exposed to, say, pornography at such an early age, it just begins to do some unusual things to their mind. But it's hard to get away from even what's piped into our TVs. Now, I love to watch good movies and things. Almost never will I be sitting by a desk study unless I've got the TV going and all kinds of stuff, all kinds of programs. But, you know, if you simply go out and get a PG movie from Redbox, what is PG now has changed to the point where you just sit down, say, this is a great action adventure, this is a futuristic thing. So my kids are sitting here, my kids, no longer, because they're at least 40 and more. But here you're watching something that is just a kind of a good, interesting film, and all at once they zap you with something, some scene, or some particularly vulgar language, and you say, what kind of image is my kid going to pick up from that? Well, rest assured, it is stored in the brain, and it does some unusual things there. We don't have time to get into that, but temptation is like that. I call it the ABCs of temptation. There is nothing that is a consistent temptation for all of us. We're all different. We have different backgrounds. But as people look at us, they listen to what we say. They probably sometimes see what we're interested in, what we look at. And as human beings, they can make some pretty good guesses about what's going on in our thinking, can't they? The kinds of, you know, jokes we tell. Well, Satan and his emissaries, wherever they are, invisible, they're probably watching us all the time. So they pick up these little clues. They report back to headquarters and say, and I won't pick on any of you, they will say, hey, Andy's got a real weakness in this area. So Satan designs a particular test, a snare that's just for me. But whatever that test is, it starts out as being appealing, really alluring. It is always going to appeal to some natural desire that I have. Don't get the idea that it's appealing to a sin nature. All temptation in the Bible appeals to a normal, natural desire that God has put into us. Now, that can be twisted when we don't use our emotions and our thinking the right way. But ultimately, everything starts with an appeal to a natural desire. It's just appealing. We walk down the street and smell those hot dogs at one of the local delis. Or John would say a pizza. Well, you know, you hadn't even thought about food. And then all at once, those senses pick up something that's so alluring that you figure, oh, I need to get a hot dog. With a banana shake, of course. You have to make sure you do it right. A chili dog. But it's always appealing. It's something that catches our attention. And again, what catches my attention may not catch your attention. But you've got a weakness. You're human. I don't know what that weakness is. but you have a weakness based upon what you've done in your past life, what experiences you've had, just basically what your interests are. So whatever your test is, whatever your temptation, will be appealing to you. Secondly, it's blinding. Now, when I put that down, I thought, now people are going to misunderstand that because they're going to say the person didn't know what they were doing. Now, I'm talking here about we blind ourselves to what we're getting involved in. If you're driving down the road, Ira Hoffman, you're on the way home, and as you get up to the main traffic light up there, you look ahead, you're 8 or 10 car lengths ahead, before the light, and you see that thing turn yellow. And you decide, I can make that. So you kind of speed up a bit, and you go barreling down there hoping to get through that light. Now you're so focused on getting through that light that you don't pay attention to anything else, and when you're halfway through the light, somebody broadsides you because they got the green light. They didn't take the time to see that you were trying to make a last-minute run for getting through that light. You're so focused, you don't see what is around you. Balaam, don't have time to go into Balaam, but it talks about the madness of the prophet. When he finally got God's okay to go at the summons of Balak of Moab, they were jangling all this money in front of him, and then they sweetened the pot with more money. So it talks about the madness of the prophet. He wanted that money. So he hops on his donkey, and of course he beats the donkey when the donkey sees the angel of the Lord. And when he's there, God won't permit him to curse Israel. So he has 5 oracles, the last of which is said he did not resort to soothsaying as he formerly had, but the Spirit of God came upon him and gave him utterance. It was another blessing for Israel, but he still wanted the money. So after his official pronouncements were done, as he's walking away, Balak had already said to him, forget you. You came here to do my bidding under contract, and you violated the contract. You don't get the money. So he's starting to walk away, but he is so focused on the money, he says, Balak, let me give you a hint. And in Numbers 21, it doesn't say what Balaam told him. It says, after he finished, he went away to his own place. But later, it talks about the counsel of Balaam that Moses reminds him that what he did on the side is to tell Balak, if you want to trip the people up, get them to commit immorality, send some of your loose women in amongst them, get them involved in immorality that will lead to adultery. And sure enough, thousands of people died when that happened because he was so focused on the money. He was not going to go home without the money, no matter what he had to do. Compromise his principles, compromise his integrity, and you and I blind ourselves sometimes to the consequences of what we're getting involved in, sometimes to the nature of the wrongness of it. There is a certain level of deception in temptation, but I think probably most of it is a self-deception where we who have been enlightened by the Spirit of God, we know pretty much what's right and wrong. How many people do you know? And I've had some pastor friends who are no longer in the ministry, who should have known better. And in fact, they say to you, Andy, I should have known better. You know, I'm not going to rub their nose in and say, yeah, you should have. Of all people, you who preached on that, you should know better. You should have known not to get involved with her. People know better, but they allow themselves to be swept along by their emotions and let the emotions tell them what to do. The third thing, it becomes so captivating and enslaving as it becomes part of our mental thought processes. And then we dabble in it. We stick the toe in one time just to see if the water's too cold. We get by with it, and then it becomes a pattern or a way of life and becomes an addiction. It could be drugs, could be sex, could be any number of things. But it all starts out with a mind that is not focused on the things of God. a mind that doesn't put God first. So, you know the rest of the story. She says to him, what's the secret of your strength? So he says, well, if you bind me with new ropes that have never been used for anything else. Well, so she waits until he's asleep. And then she says, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. So he wakes up and just breaks those things like they're twine or thread. So she knew she'd been duped. So this happens a second time. Finally, she keeps on, keeps on, keeps on until she wears him down. And he said, incidentally, this is one of the sobering things. He said, I have been a Nazarite from my birth. He knew what God wanted him to do. He knew what God wanted him to stand for. So when he says to her, I've been a Nazarite since my birth, that means my hair has never been cut. And if my hair is cut, I will lose my strength. So she, actually, this is not an accurate picture. She doesn't cut the hair. She's probably cradling his head on her lap, and she summons somebody in, and they cut the seven locks of his head. And then she says, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. So he shook himself out of sleep and said, I'll just get up and break these bands. And sadly, the verse says, he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. Isn't that sobering? When Samuel anointed David, the Spirit came upon him. And the very next verse in that chapter, Samuel says, and the Spirit departed from Saul, the Spirit of anointing, to be the king of Israel. When God chooses people for a task, he wants them to be set aside and devoted to it. But there is a point at which God says, all right, you don't want my blessing on your life? I'll just withdraw it. And that's exactly what happened. By the way, I should mention this. Don't ever make the mistake. If people say to you, where did Samson get his strength? Don't ever say his hair. Because it's clear from here that it's when the Spirit of God came upon him that he was able to do these great things. Now, the fact that his hair was long meant he was still holding, at least to that part of the Nazarite vow. The fact that he had his hair cut meant he had betrayed his Nazarite vow, and that's why God's hand of blessing was withdrawn from him. So that's the story as you see it there. And then I put here the bitter fruit of losing God's blessing. When they capture him on that last occasion with Delilah, it says they put out his eyes, and then they put him in the grinding house where only beasts and the lowliest of slaves were to turn these threshing wheels. I don't think it says exactly how long he was there. At least I forgot to check. But anyway, this was a very, very sad sight to see this great warrior of God reduced to the work of an oxen. And probably this picture is right about one thing. People probably, who knows, they probably sold tickets. You know, come and see Samson. And here they're standing around the wall. This group leaves and then they bring another group in. How sad to see him reduced to that level. If I were to say, who's to blame? We would say, I know. He would never have been there if he himself hadn't made the choices that he did. But you see, God is the one who gets blamed for the behavior of his kids. Now, let me point that out in just a few minutes. Finally, they decide, we're going to have a great big celebration. This is not an accurate picture of Dagon. He was a fish god, had a mitre head. But anyway, they had a big open area, and they had these balconies, and people would come and watch the festivities down here, including offerings to their false deity. So they bring out Samson. It doesn't say what they force him to do, but they make him put on a show for them of some sort. How degrading that is. Then Samson, as he's being jeered at, laughed at, ridiculed, he says to this little fellow next to him, "Plant my hands on the two main pillars of the temple." And he did. And it says that his hair had begun to grow while he was in prison, but still, it's the strength that comes only from God. And he prayed to God, "Lord, just one last time, let me take vengeance on these Philistines." Now he says, "For the loss of my eyes." But you see, God knew what's taking place here. Incidentally, back when he chose the woman of Timnah, and he says to his father, "I want this woman. Nobody else is going to do it. It has to be this woman." And it says that they, the parents, did not realize that this was of the Lord to bring about judgment on the Philistines. So anyway, in this balcony here, there are 3,000 or more of the generals and military people probably gathered together to make a lot of fun of the biggest opponent they'd ever faced. And while they're there, the sad thing is what they say, verse 23 of chapter 16, "Our God has delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy. When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, 'Our God,'" that's Dagon, "'has delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land and the one who multiplied our dead." You see, these cultures had practiced a thing that was called henotheism. The main God, the strongest God, is the one who always gets the victory. So if you overcame an opponent, that meant that your God was stronger than the God, in this instance, of Israel. That's why often they would go into the temple, they would take the sacred things like Nebuchadnezzar did in the instance of Belshazzar, and they would put them in the temple of their God because they were trophies of a defeated God from a different country. So what these people were saying here is, "Our God is greater than the God of Samson because our God defeated him." When I said that the way you and I behave reflects on the Lord, but it's never fair, is it, when as a parent you've done the best you possibly can, and for some reason one of your children will make a choice that is totally dishonoring to you, to the family, to the Lord? What explains that? Well, human choice explains it. But you see, you don't get a chance to defend yourself. You live with the shame. The same thing is true of the Lord. When David committed sin with Bathsheba, Nathan the prophet said to him, "You have given the enemies of the Lord an occasion to blaspheme." Because when God looks at you and me as a Christian, when people look at you and me as a Christian, we say we stand for something, and that is what? The righteousness of God, the character of God. And then all kinds of ways we don't live up to that high calling that God has put upon our lives. Who's the one who gets the blame? Who's the one who gets ill spoken of them? Yeah, you and I do, that's true. But sadly, the name of our God is blasphemed because you and I don't live an honorable life. By the way, we're human. We're not perfect. We're going to have many occasions where we really blow it. But God is faithful and forgiving. And all he wants of us is to come to him and say, "Lord, I acknowledge that what I've done is wrong." And we accept his cleansing and forgiveness. Boy, I'm glad that's a part of the gospel story. So he pushes the pillars apart, and the roof falls in on all the rest of them, and 3,000 of them are killed. And it says that he killed more on this one occasion than in all of his battles with the Philistines before. Now, we started with this. As a parent, I had such, in fact, I still do, had such great hopes for my kids. And Charlotte and I watched as they grew up. We were gratified to see they're making responsible decisions. We've soon realized the battle's never completely over. And sometimes they come limping back. And sometimes they need help. Sometimes they just want to talk to somebody. God has high hopes for all of us. He's divinely selected you and made you accepted in the Beloved. He has set you apart as uniquely His. He has provided the strength of His Spirit to provide the leadership and the strength and all of those things. So that if I make a mistake, it's always, 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 always my fault. It's not because God shortchanged me. It's not because God did something wrong. It is always because of the choices that I make. So over here, what we're going to say about Samson's low conduct. He's an embarrassment, isn't he? That's, by the way, that's not the rest of the story. He dishonored his call. He saw something. He wanted. He went for it. Outside the law of God. Consorted with a harlot. Outside of his Nazarite vow. Touched a wild, dead animal. Philippians 3? It talks about whose God is their belly. People live dominated by their passions. And increasingly in our culture, where God has left out no standards, you will find people living. Passions are what rule their lives. No standards. He degraded his life. Don't have to say a lot about that. We rehearsed it. I just want to remind you. And then finally, he disgraced his God. So as I look at Samson, and as a former teacher, I'm always tempted to grade him. Do I give him an F for being a miserable failure? Do I give him an A for really being a thorn in the side of the Philistines? You know, it's never either or, is it? Let me remind you that God's verdict is the one that matters. You and I sometimes will Monday morning quarterback, we will look at somebody and say, they just don't measure up. Half the time it's because we want to measure up, so we degrade other people so that we look better. That's not always the full story. But sometimes we just look at somebody in the Bible, we second guess what they should have done. Remember, we've got more information than they do. We've got more of the light of God. We've certainly got a lot of things that we're accountable for, that Acts chapter 17, the times of this ignorance. Old King James says God winked at. No, God doesn't wink at sin. The word there in the Greek is he closed his eyes to it. The times of this ignorance, God closed his eyes to, because they didn't have the law. They didn't have the revelation. They had a law part of the time. They didn't have the New Testament revelation. So God closed his eyes to certain things they did in the Old Testament. But now he commands men everywhere to repent. So as you and I look at Samson, how do you picture Samson? What's the last image that comes to mind? Fighting a lion? By the way, I chose some vivid, colorful ones here to make it look better. Fighting the Philistines, killing 1,000 of them. Pushing down a whole temple. Great picture, isn't it? But let's put that into a kind of a parable picture. What's a way you would describe Samson? Oh, yeah. You would say a train wreck. That's a great picture of Samson. Because after all, except for Solomon, who had wisdom beyond belief, and yet he just worshiped false idols at the bidding of his wives. But Samson is probably right up there in terms of failure, at least in this area. So in a way, I would say train wreck's a good picture. Let me give you another one. Charlotte was just too worn out from yesterday because we had most of her family in. The crew of five from Florida couldn't make it. So it's a lively crew when they get together. So I was going to put this up there and tell you that was Charlotte's kitchen after the after the grandkids left yesterday. But it's no fun to tease if she's not over there threatening me, you know, with those. Let me put another one up there. How many of you have seen a house like that? I have. Back when we were raising a family of four, I mean, sometimes there were times I worked total three jobs. One of them was a maintenance supervisor in a set of apartment buildings in Greenbelt. They were old World War II Army barracks that somebody had renovated into apartments. There was one old lady who lived at the left end of that whole bank of apartments, first floor. On a hot day, you could be halfway up the block and you could smell her apartment. Well, I think there was a sink trap that needed work on it. I walked into that apartment. Now, this literally is not an exaggeration. There was no place in that apartment where my feet could touch the floor. I would be walking on trash bags full of old clothing. Way back then, I never thought to take a picture. But when I came across that, I thought, oh, yeah, I know that apartment. I know her well. Well, neighbors complained, well, what could they do? You know, low rent. And the fella who was there didn't want to make waves. The reason I'm putting this up here, 3 or 4 days ago, I think one of the mails from the Blaze, it gave me one of those stories. Somehow I deleted it and forgot to get the information. But there was a lady in Florida who died. 1976. She had decided to become a recluse from society after two failed marriages. So after 40-some years, then she died. And she was well-known in the community for going through trash bags and everything else, trash cans, finding something to eat. Well, when they went to clean out her apartment, yeah, it was a pretty bad mess. But stuffed away in drawers and shoes and everything else, they rounded up well over $1 million. She was rich, but she lived like a pauper. You and I are rich, but we can live like a pauper. Samson was rich. He chose to live like a pauper. Yeah, God used him for a purpose. Let me ask one final question. What about Hebrews 11? Does this mean that Samson got a pass? Paul says, what more can I say to talk about, oh, look at Gideon and Barak and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets. Boy, there's a name of Samson. Who through faith overcame kingdoms, stopped the mouths of lions. That's probably Daniel in chapter 6 of Daniel. But still, I think Samson did a good job of that, stopping the mouth of that lion. Out of weakness were made strong. As a human being, he was weak. But the power of God came upon him. He did great feats, became mighty in battle, turned to flight of the armies. I look at that and say, how'd Samson ever make that? A big photograph in the Hall of Faith that he's one of the notable warriors who, through faith, accomplished what God wanted. Well, now, God wanted him to be a mighty warrior and to be a thorn in the side of the Philistines. He did exactly that. But he compartmentalized his life to the point that at one point he said, God has given me the victory. He knew all the right things, but he was also doing a lot of the wrong things. He figured if I can be faithful in this area, then God's going to kind of overlook this area. Now, let me point out something very importantly, and that is my final conclusion. The lesson we need to learn is God used Samson despite his lack of spiritual and moral qualifications, because his purpose of delivering Israel and judging the Philistines was bigger than one individual. Rest assured that when Samson died, he had the same prospect that you and I have. That is, we stand before God, we get a reward for doing things well, but we're also held accountable for what we did that was wrong. As a Christian, that's paid for by the death of Christ on the cross. That's true. But it's possible for a Christian, 1 John, to be ashamed at his coming because of the way that believer is living. So whether it's the judgment seat of Christ, whether it's a great white throne judgment, nobody gets a pass. We're declared to be guilty, but the grace of God simply says that if you acknowledge that guilt and you know I've got a pardon waiting for you and you accept that gift of forgiveness and salvation, it's yours. And then as a Christian, if we happen, 1 John chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, if any man might sin, doesn't say he has to, if any man might sin, we have an advocate with the Father. It should not be a way of life for a believer, but we're human. So the challenge this year, beginning this afternoon, is to be aware that Satan is going to be attacking us from all different quarters. What's in front of us is obvious and we know, but if we're not careful, we can be blindsided in something that we think, an area of our life, we think we're really strong, so we let down our defenses. And then when the dust finally settles, we say, you know, I knew better. I knew it could happen, but I never thought it would happen to me. But hopefully at the end of this year, we can look back and say, by the grace of God, I had a lot of victories as it relied upon his strength and his wisdom. Will that be your prayer for this coming year? Shall we stand in closing prayer? Now, you may or may not have forgotten, we've got food downstairs, carrying dinner. When I close in prayer, we just ask the Lord's blessing so you don't have to wait for all of us to get down there and have a separate prayer. But you're invited to hang around, even if you didn't remember to bring something. Father, we thank you for your great grace unto us. It would be so easy for us to look at Samson and say, oh, yeah, he's different. But we see a man who was only too human, a man who in some occasions followed your way and honored you with some of the great things he did in his life, but someone who also probably excused certain things that he got involved in that he should never have even looked at. And there, but for the grace of God, go we. You remind us that we need to rely upon your strength and your wisdom for our daily walk, and what a great God we serve when we think that you made the sacrifice to provide forgiveness of our sins. And as we confess our sins in our daily walk, we have your forgiveness and your cleansing, and we can bring honor and praise to your holy name. Might that be our prayer, beginning today and tomorrow as the new year begins. And we thank you for all your riches and your blessings. We thank you for the food that many of us will partake of downstairs, and also for the food for all the rest of us who perhaps will be eating different places. But might this year coming be a time of conscious praise, where we always honor you with everything that we say and do. Give us strength from the food to serve you, in Christ's name. Amen.